This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The United States Supreme Court issued yet another ruling this week, this time preserving a ban on gun ownership for those convicted of domestic violence. The case was brought by two men, Stephen Voisin and William Armstrong in Maine, who felt they should not be subjected to the existing federal gun ban because their domestic violence convictions were a result of recklessness and not intentional. Studies have shown that people who are abused by their spouses are 5 times more likely to be murdered when there is a gun present. My guest is Ron LeGrand. He is the Vice President of Public Policy at the National Network to End Domestic Violence. Welcome to the program, Ron.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about what is already in existence. I mentioned this federal ban on gun ownership of anyone convicted of a domestic violence incident. So this is a federal ban, meaning it applies to all states. How effective has this ban just by itself been, setting aside this new Supreme Court ruling?
The ban has been somewhat effective. We can always do better, and we're working aggressively, encouraging members of Congress to close some existing gaps in the federal firearms laws, so that currently those who are not covered by the federal ban include folks who are convicted of stalking, and folks who commit acts of violence against people whom they do not live with, against dating partners. So those are areas that require additional attention on the part of Congress. And there's legislation pending that could close those gaps.
Right, and we'll turn to that later in our conversation. Let's talk about the actual ruling, a 6-2 decision, so not a close split. Justice Elena Kagan basically said that there's no distinction between somebody who sort of recklessly is involved in domestic violence versus someone who does it intentionally. She said, quote, "A person who assaults another recklessly uses force no less than one who carries out that same action knowingly or intentionally." How important was what she was saying? Because these two men who brought this suit were basically saying, you know, what we did, whatever their specific cases were the result of recklessness rather than intentionality.
Well, the important thing here is that and she talked extensively about the use of force. The knowingly talks about, you know, we do something, we use force, we set something in motion with a purpose or specific intent to bring about a specific outcome or result. The recklessness, however, doesn't require that specific intent. It only requires that one knew or should have known the consequences of their putting that particular act in motion.
Right. And it's interesting because the ban that is in place that these two men feel that they shouldn't have been subject to was passed in by Congress in 1996, that basically individuals convicted of domestic violence misdemeanors cannot legally own or buy guns. It's called the Lautenberg Amendment. And so going back to whether this has been effective or not, this is basically one of the few places that I understand that the federal government actually bars individuals from owning guns. Is that accurate?
That is correct. That is correct. And it's a good law. The late Senator Lautenberg, this law is named after him. Let's face it, without this law, there's a very real likelihood that there would be even more casualties, more fatalities in domestic violence situations. So it's a great step in the right direction, but we need more.
Okay, so how is this law enforced? So these two men who now the court has upheld do have to abide by this gun ban. Tomorrow, if they wanted to go out and try to legally purchase guns, how would they be prevented from doing so?
Well, they would apply for they would go to purchase a gun, and there should be a background check. And ideally, the background check would disclose the existence of the convictions, the domestic violence convictions. Now, this is where there's a flaw in the system, because the reporting of those convictions is not consistent. States need to do a much better job in reporting the convictions as they occur. If one is convicted of this offense and the state hasn't made that report of the conviction available to the FBI, then it's entirely possible that the person who's convicted of the offense can go out and purchase a firearm. Now, the court, upon conviction, should inform the individual that he or she is not legally permitted to purchase or possess a firearm. And to go even further, the court should order that individual to turn in their firearms, or instruct the sheriff or local law enforcement to confiscate the firearms. Now, there's an inconsistency on this, and some states are very aggressive in the enforcement of that, and go so far as to require judges to give the convicted individual the notice. Other states don't require that. They leave it up to the judge, and other states just don't require it at all. And so even at the state level, there's some more work that needs to be done just in terms of enforcing these prohibitions.
Ron, you are in the business of ending domestic violence, not specifically in the business of gun control. Why is gun control such an intimately linked issue with domestic violence? Can you make that case? I mentioned one statistic about people who are in abusive situations being five times more likely to be murdered when there's a gun around. Is that the sort of linchpin of this conversation?
Very much so. It's also important to understand that domestic violence can be an escalating situation. It may start out as something, quote unquote, relatively minor, and just goes, you know, further and further. So that with each successive incident, each following incident, the domestic violence gets more extreme. And so it may be that the first instance of domestic violence involves a touching, an offensive touching, but then it goes on and on and on, and
so it can spiral out of control.
It can spiral out of control, and there again, where there's a firearm in the environment in which that escalating domestic violence is occurring, the potential for the use of that firearm, the potential for the deadly use of that firearm, also escalates, as you mentioned at the outset of our conversation.
Right. Now, there's this really bizarre story that emerged just in the last few days of a woman, a mother of two girls, Christy Sheets, a gun rights activist, who was in a, basically, you know, called a family meeting in her house. And this is in Texas, and shot her two teenage daughters, shot at her husband too, but he managed to escape, shot her one daughter in the house, and then literally chased her other daughter and shot her down in the streets. Now, this is an unusual situation because it's a woman involved in actually doing the shooting. It's much more often that that it's the man doing the abusing rather than the woman. But here is an example of what might have been a family argument turning into something so horrifically deadly. It's ironic that this woman, Christy Sheets, just a few months ago made a public statement. She was a staunch NRA activist, and she said, "It would be horribly tragic if my ability to protect myself or my family were to be taken away, but that's exactly what Democrats are determined to do by banning semi-automatic weapons." Ron, this kind of a situation where people claim that guns are there to protect their families, how often do those situations turn into ones where the families themselves inadvertently or intentionally become the target?
You know, Sonali, I don't have that information, but I got to tell you, I had not heard of this tragic incident here. And it is tragic. You know, the gun lobby says that it makes you believe that everybody has a right to possess firearms, the right to bear arms. They keep talking about that. But it's not an unrestricted right. It is a right of people who have the legal right, who can legally possess firearms. And that legally possess is the important distinction. It doesn't cover people who are adjudicated mentally ill. People have felony convictions. They are not legally entitled to have firearms. But the NRA doesn't talk about that. And I think that it's a very dangerous message that they put out.
One of the men in the case, Voisin versus the United States, had been convicted of misdemeanor assault of his girlfriend, not once, but twice, once in 2003 and once in 2005. That is consistent with what you were saying earlier on about how it starts with one incident and then builds up and often spirals out of control. And yet this person thought that he still had the right to own a gun. Why is it that something like domestic violence is not in the minds of society even seen as a crime? Even the term domestic violence, something that's, you know, domestic implies something not horrible, something not criminal, and yet owning a gun is seen as a right. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on the sort of semantics. This phrase domestic violence, it feels to me, doesn't fully express the violence and criminality of what it actually is.
Part of what we're dealing with is we're still coming out of a decades-long history in which what we call domestic violence was a really hush-hush kind of issue. It was deemed to be very personal. It was something that was kept behind closed doors. It was something that wasn't discussed. We're just beginning, I'll say, in the last couple of decades to begin to talk about this. And you see, especially in the last, I'll say, couple of years, where reports of domestic violence are increasing because we understand now that this is something that cannot and should not and should frankly never have been held behind closed doors. People are being hurt, they're being victimized, they're being killed, they're being terrorized. It needs to be known. And by the same token, people who are on the receiving end, people who are the victims, need to know that there is relief, that there are places that they can go, that there are organizations whom they can call, that there are ways in which they can get away from that violent environment that they're in.
So, Ron, let's continue what we started out discussing. You mentioned there are pieces of legislation that could close the loopholes that still exist. I mean, this Supreme Court decision sounds very significant, but in the grand scheme of things, it's actually not that significant. It's small. It's simply saying that the existing federal ban can apply to domestic violence related misdemeanors, even in cases where it was reckless rather than intentional. So what more needs to be done? What would you, as an advocate against domestic violence, like to see on gun control?
Well, let's make sure that those who are convicted of stalking are also included in the ban. Let's see that those who, if you have a permanent restraining order, you are not allowed to possess a firearm. However, if the restraining order is temporary, the door is open. You can still purchase a firearm, and that needs to be addressed as well. You know, when a victim goes to seek a restraining order, very often it's a two-step process. The temporary restraining order is issued first. And that can be where the impulse to respond violently occurs. And the object of the restraining order may seek revenge or retaliation against the petitioner of the restraining order, and that retaliation may involve the use of a firearm. So we need to close that loophole as well.
And so finally, is there, broadly speaking, you know, you think any greater chance that Congress would actually do something about these things than before? I mean, I mentioned the Lautenberg Amendment. That passed in 1996, so 20 years ago. Last week, Democrats in the House or Democrats actually had a sit-in in the House for a very modest gun control measure. And it just goes to show the kind of stranglehold that the NRA has on Republicans and conservatives and gun proliferation activists and those who, you know, feel that everybody should be able to buy guns. And we just seem to, you know, walk away despite the horrific Orlando shooting, saying there's just nothing it seems we can do about guns because our, you know, the NRA has bought and paid for enough members of Congress. Is there enough political will to start changing things, or are we just supposed to be stuck?
Well, Sonali, I hope that we won't be stuck. I got to tell you, I'm frustrated. I worked on Capitol Hill. I just retired from Capitol Hill last year. I saw gun legislation introduced and no action, and it left me wondering. If Congress fails to respond when innocent school children, babies in Connecticut, are slaughtered, if Congress fails to respond when one of its own, Gabby Giffords, is almost killed, and if Congress can't respond to all of the mass shootings, and Sonali, let's also acknowledge that while the mass shootings are certainly horrific, no one is talking about the shootings and the killings that happen on a daily basis across the country. And we only need to cite the city of Chicago, South Side of Chicago, which is, you know, the residents of that community are living in terror. So I don't know what it's going to take to get them being Congress to act. I applaud the House of Democrats for the action they took last week, and John Lewis has been a lifelong hero of mine. I was happy to see some of my former bosses, Bobby Scott, Sheila Jackson Lee, out there and participating in this sit-in. That took courage, it took integrity, and we need more of that, not less. And, you know, they may have violated the House rules in their actions, but if that's what it takes to get the attention of the country and hopefully to get some action out of Congress, then so be it. And well, let me also applaud Senator, I'm drawing a blank on him, from Connecticut, who filibustered the week before. We need those kinds of bold actions on the part of our elected officials. It is what it's what we deserve from them.
And Ron, just finally, on the point that you made earlier, I think it is really crucial for us to acknowledge that the country becomes justifiably shocked when we have mass shootings, but the everyday, the day-to-day shootings, one shooting here, one there, especially the ones that that happen within a context of domestic violence, just don't get nearly enough attention as they do because they don't have that shock value. And so I think that's a really important aspect. Give out a website for your organization, Ron, so that people can find out more.
Yes, it is nnedv.org. That's for the National Network to End Domestic Violence.
Well, thank you so much, Ron. We'll post a link to that from our website later today.
Sonali, thank you so much, and thank you for inviting us to be on your show.
My guest is Ron LeGrand. He is the Vice President of Public Policy at the National Network to End Domestic Violence. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.